I'd like to thank the Center for the Study of Race and Law for asking me to give this talk, and thank Professor Ford Mazzarui for that, as well as thanking Tim for those two generous remarks. I should mention that I was chair of the Appointments Committee when we hired Professor Ford Mazzarui, so I take some pride in the establishment in the Center and getting Professor Ford Mazzarui to come here as opposed to the other schools that I wanted in that year. So today's topic obviously is about affirmative action. It's entitled A Reply to a Systemic Analysis of Affirmative Action in American Law Schools, Flaws in the Theory. And as Professor Ford Mazzarui's email indicated, I'm going to talk about affirmative action, but I'm not going to talk about affirmative action generally, the pros and cons, the efficacy of affirmative action, the legality of affirmative action, the Supreme Court's treatment of affirmative action, including most recently the Grutter case, and then the Seattle case. What I'm really going to talk about today was, a response to Rick Sanders' 2005 article, A Systemic Analysis of Affirmative Action in American Law Schools. At the time the article was published in 2005, as Tim mentioned, I was the dean at the University of Minnesota Law School and didn't really have time to prepare an adequate response to what I perceived as a flawed thesis. Of course, since then, I've been able to devote the time to reviewing the paper as well as his reply to critics, which I think some of you have read, and that's led to my response. So what I'm going to talk about today is really a response to Professor Sanders' article. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with Professor Sanders' thesis, I'll go over a little bit of that as well. But before I begin, I'd like to start with a couple of caveats to ensure that we're all sort of on the same page. First, for those of you who have read Rick Sanders' article, and also his second article, A Reply to the Critics, which I think the second article, A Reply to the Critics, is the quickest way to understand Sanders' mismatch thesis and to examine quickly four of the critiques of that thesis, you'll note that a lot of the criticism is focused on the alleged methodological flaws in Sanders' research and its conclusions. And part of that's due to the fact that Sanders uses two databases. He uses one database that is called the Bar Passage Study Database, which was a study of law school students entering in 1991, matriculating in 1991 at essentially the 139 ABA-approved law schools, and graduating in 1994. And that study, which was basically produced by the Law School Admissions Council, followed those graduates through four administrations of the bar exam. And it's the only national longitudinal bar exam study that we have. And much of his data, much of his assertions, conclusions come from the use of that, what we call the BPS, the Bar Passage Study. The other set of data is a set that focuses on students matriculating in 2001 and graduating in 2004. It's based on another sort of research project instituted by Linda Whiteman at the Law School Admissions Council to look at grades and the normalized grades among law schools and to see how many law students would be admitted without the benefit of affirmative action. So he takes two different data sets, draws some conclusions from that, and I don't fault him for that because these are the only two data sets that are available. So it's not as though he could have taken a data set and gone to, say, the 1991 data set, looked at those students and looked how well they passed the bar and then compared them to the students who matriculated in 2001. So I don't criticize them for the methodological flaws, if any, and indeed, if there are methodological flaws, and I'm not competent to point them out because I'm not a psychometrician nor am I an empiricist. So I don't deal with the empirical side of his argument, and I take as given his claims based on his analysis of the data. Second, and this isn't so much a caveat as is what I perceive to be useful information, both to explain my limited expertise and also my biases. I have spent almost 20 years working as a volunteer for the Law School Admissions Council, the group that produced the LSAT, which I think all of you took, right? And they also produced, as I mentioned, the Bar Passage Study and the second data set of students matriculating in 2001. And indeed, this will become relevant hopefully momentarily, I was on the original Bar Passage Study Group in 1988 through 1990 when we devised the BPS, the Bar Passage Study, and by the time it was finished and produced in 2000, I was the chair of the Law School Admissions Council. So I've had a long history in working with the Law School Admissions Council and also with these particular data sets. So I am somewhat biased in favor of, promoting the LSAC, but I also think I have some expertise in dealing with the information that Professor Sanders is using to make his claims. Third, I want to sort of situate Sanders' thesis as part of what I call the larger debate over affirmative action, because I think the article is kind of interesting, not because it's critical of affirmative action, but because of the way it's critical. Initially, if you go back and look at the criticisms of affirmative action, most of it focused on the fact that affirmative action was equated with quotas. And we quickly got beyond that. Quotas were eliminated, and the next wave of attack focused on what I call the nexus harm sort of rationale, that those being benefited by affirmative action were not necessarily those who were harmed by racial discrimination in the past. And then, of course, there was a philosophical argument against affirmative action that someone is being denied distributive justice because he or she loses a benefit getting into a law school because of, quote, an irrelevant characteristic, race, which shouldn't matter. That led to basically the reverse discrimination argument that some may be benefited, but the harm, those who are not being admitted to law school, outweighs the benefit and therefore shouldn't have affirmative action. And then finally, you have a wave of articles, or at least I've read a wave of articles, that focuses on what I call stigma arguments, that affirmative action is wrong because it stigmatizes those who are benefited from affirmative action, and therefore, Justice Thomas is a proponent of this, and therefore should be, quote, eliminated. This attack, if you will, or criticism, I guess I should say, is a little bit different. It looks like the stigma argument, but it really isn't. If you go back to the Grutter and Gratz case, you'll note that Justice O'Connor talks about the benefits of affirmative action, the benefits that are created when we have a diverse student body, and she alleges those benefits outweigh the cost. This article is slightly different because its basic premise is that there's another cost to affirmative action. It's not stigma, it's not harm to those who are not admitted as a result of affirmative action, it's actual harm to the beneficiaries, and harm in a sense that we do not obtain the benefit that we think we're getting from diversity. Basically, the argument is if you think we're getting a diverse student body and if you think we're getting a diverse bar through affirmative action, we're really not, because as a result of affirmative action, the end result of affirmative action, rather, is that we produce fewer lawyers, so that the so-called benefit that we obtain from affirmative action is not a benefit at all. That if we really prize diversity and if we really want to have a diverse bar, we do better without affirmative action. So it shifts the critique, I think, 180 degrees, and basically says the author says, I buy into the notion that diversity is good, but if you really want diversity, you shouldn't have affirmative action. Affirmative action is bad. You wind up with less diversity. And in a nutshell, here's Rick Sanders, Professor Sanders' mismatch hypothesis. He states, and I'll actually say what I agree and disagree with, that blacks get admitted to better law schools because of affirmative action. And when he says better law schools, he means more selective. And there's some pejorative terms, elite, whatever, but basically we use selective. Selectivity being based on the number of applicants and the number of matriculants. So he says that blacks get admitted to better schools. I agree. He also says that as a result of being admitted to better schools, blacks cannot. And he uses the term blacks, and he states, I'm only going to focus on blacks because if I were to focus on Asian Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans, it would conflate things and make things very difficult. So the focus is clearly solely on blacks. He also says that as a result, blacks cannot compete successfully with whites in the classroom. Third, and I think there's some truth to that, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Third, he says, as a result of this mismatch, blacks earn lower grades in law school. And for that, he uses, both the Bar Passage Study, but mostly the 2001 data set. Then he says that grades are correlated to bar passage. Law school grades are correlated to bar passage, which is what I disagree with. And then he says that lower bar passage rates result occur as a result of the lower grades that blacks receive in law school. And then he makes a prediction. He says there are less black lawyers because of the use of affirmative action, and that if we have no affirmative action, we'll actually have ultimately more black lawyers. And that, in a nutshell, is his mismatch hypothesis. Indeed, to be quite precise, Sanders details the fact that blacks, on average, and this was not something that wasn't known before his article, score one standard deviation below whites on the LSAT. And that translates, at least with respect to the data set that he uses, with blacks receiving a mean score of 143 on the LSAT compared to whites and, by the way, Asians, mean score of 153. And that 10-point gap in the LSAT score is quite persistent and is not affected by socioeconomic status or any other variable. So that if you look at similarly situated whites and blacks, what you see along the SES continuum, the socioeconomic stratum, you see this 10-point gap. So, and back to Sanders' thesis, next he says that this gap creates what he calls a cascade effect in law school admission. And that he states that the result of that is that that affirmative action is used in just about every American law school, and a contention that I'll deal with momentarily. As a result of this gap, Sander alleges a mismatch is created between the black applicant and the law school which he or she matriculates at when you compare that student to the white applicant or the white matriculant. He gives two examples. He says a black student who gets into Harvard with the 165 LSAT is mismatched when you look at the fact that the average matriculant at Harvard has an LSAT score of 172. And he says that as a result, that student with the 165 LSAT should instead go to Boston University, where the median LSAT is 165. The second example he gives is a student who matriculates at Vanderbilt, a black student matriculates at Vanderbilt with the 158 LSAT, and he says that student is mismatched because that student is going to be competing with a white student with a median LSAT of 165, or mean LSAT of 165. So basically what he's arguing is that because of the use of affirmative action, blacks get into better schools, they have to compete for grades with students with better LSAT scores, and as a result of that, they don't do well. So I can agree in part with the view that if you're competing against stronger students based on one metric, there is a probability, and it could be from strong to weak depending on the differential and depending on the correlation between the index, the LSAT, and grades, that black students may score lower grades as a result. So, as I said earlier, I buy that in part. What he then goes on to say is that correlates to lower bar passage rates. And that's where I have some problems with his thesis. He says that blacks learn less at what he calls highly selective law schools. And therefore, he says their grades are even lower than they should be. He also says that, to some extent, the grades are not reflective, and this is sort of contradictory, grades may not be reflective of how poorly students do at some law schools, not elite, because liberal law professors may choose not to fail students when perhaps they should. And last, he claims that if you look at the performance of black students, what might be happening in law school is that because of lower grades, they may be tuning out, and they may be less concerned with, and he uses as an example his own experience when he was failing German at Harvard, that he didn't really pay that much attention in class because he was doing so poorly when compared to the other students in the class. So he says, essentially based on this anecdote, that students who do poorly in class tune out. They don't learn as much. And then one other thing, which he sort of says and then doesn't say, but the last point is when a student gets into a, quote, lesser law school as opposed to a less selective law school, they might learn more law. I mean, that's sort of what he says. And then later at the end of the piece, he says, well, maybe that's not true because the data doesn't show that. But it's sort of implied that when you go to a lesser law school, when you go to a Tennessee versus a Vanderbilt, or when you go to a Boston University versus a Harvard, because you're not up there in the rarefied status of this elite law school, they actually teach you law. And so when you take the bar exam, you might be more prepared. So essentially, that's his thesis, and he has some numbers, which is based on the second data set. He says that if affirmative action is eliminated, he recognizes there's a cost. If affirmative action is eliminated, there will be 14% fewer blacks admitted to law schools for the class that matriculated in 2001. That's the second data set. So we would have 3,182 blacks admitted to law school versus the 3,706 who were actually admitted. So, and then he says fewer still would matriculate. So we have a drop of almost 15%. 2,983 blacks would matriculate at various law schools versus the 3,474 that actually did. But, and here's the kicker, he says that they would perform better in law school because they would be at the appropriate law school based on their LSAT. And therefore, at the end of the day, you would graduate slightly more lawyers, here's a table, but more of those lawyers would pass the bar. And indeed, he says 2,150 individuals of the 2,983 would pass the bar versus, not to throw too many numbers at you, 1,981 of the 3,474 who actually did pass the bar. So you've got 1,981 of 3,474 in that group that matriculated in 2001 and graduated in 2004. Under his, I guess, proposal, which would be the elimination of affirmative action, you would have 2,983 attending and 2,150 of those would allegedly pass the bar, which would result in, voila, a net gain of 169 more black or African American lawyers. Okay? And the inference stated throughout, throughout the piece, although not stated directly, is that black students at selective or elite schools are disproportionately flunking the bar, because those are the examples he gives when he talks about elite schools and the fact that there's a mismatch at these elite schools and students would do better by going to a Tennessee versus a Vanderbilt or a Boston versus a Harvard. So he never says directly, though, which students are flunking the bar disproportionately. So I want to try and just basically unpack his thesis, this mismatch hypothesis, and start with a critique. But before I get to the critique, I guess I'll give you a couple of observations that are relevant to my critique. First, there is a score scale gap which exists when blacks take the LSAT. And as I indicated, it's persistent. No one knows why it occurs. And it occurs on every standardized test, okay? Not just the LSAT. And if questioned, when we have time for questions, I can demonstrate that the LSAT is not discriminatory. But there is that gap. So it is true that there is this 10-point differential. It used to be 15. Used to be 1.5 standard deviations. It's actually narrowing. And so the set he uses, there is one standard deviation, 10-point difference between the mean score of blacks and whites. Second, although Professor Sander finds this to be puzzling, or no, he doesn't say puzzling. He says he found it surprising. He thought affirmative action only existed at elite schools and selective schools. And he was surprised by how pervasive affirmative action is in all law schools, and he came to the conclusion, based on his review of the data, that it's used in all law schools. I just don't know why he finds that surprising. It stands to reason that if Harvard values diversity and is willing to use affirmative action, that Boston University would also value diversity and would employ affirmative action. And part of what he describes makes a lot of sense intuitively, what he calls a cascade effect. And here's what I mean by that. I looked up some data today, and I was able to get the LSAT scores of African-American students for the 2006 entering class. For the 2006 entering class, those people are going to be graduating next year in May. How many of you are class 2009? Okay, for that group, the LSAT scores, there were 25 African-Americans who scored between 170 and 180. 25 total in the United States, period. Okay? Now, think about it this way. Harvard, Yale, Stanford, meaning LSAT of 172. They each want to have a diverse class, meaning more than just a few African Americans. So those schools are fighting over the 170s to 180. You get down to the 160s and 170s, there are 240 African Americans total that year out of, like, I think 4,000 matriculants who had 160, I actually didn't write down the matriculants, so don't hold me to that, who had an LSAT score between 160 and 170. And then 150 to 160 the mean being 153. There were 1,517 African Americans above 150. And so when you take the 1,517 that were 150 to 160, the 240 that were 160 to 170, the 25 that were 170 to 180, you have basically 1,782 individuals above 150 on the LSAT for that class. And so what you see is the, quote, more selective schools take the top, the 25, 170 to 180s. They then move on and take some of the 160s to 170s, leaving those schools who have a median of 165, say in the hypothetical, the Boston University, to take those below 165 and so on and so on and so forth. So the cascade effects does exist, and I'm not sure why it's so surprising. But in any event, with those two caveats, here's sort of my critique of the, I need to say one other thing of the study. A lot of the study is premised on the fact that there's a differential bar passage rate between whites and blacks. And that was proven conclusively by the bar passage study. And the bar passage study used two different indices to measure bar passage. One was first time bar passage, and the other was what they call eventual bar passage. And most people have settled on eventual bar passage as the true indicator of bar passage, because what we're concerned about is not whether people pass on the first, second, or third time, but whether people actually become lawyers, which is, quote, the goal of going to law school, we hope. So if you look at eventual bar passage for the group that matriculated in 1991 and graduated in 1994, the bar passage rates for African Americans, 78%. For whites, it's 97%. So you have the differential of 19%. And people have asked, well, why is that? Once again, and I'll talk a little bit more about this, it is indeed a standardized test. But the one thing I should impress upon you at the time that we did the bar passage study, the anecdotal evidence was that the bar passage rates for African Americans was about 10%. So when we did the study, we were very happy. I mean, we weren't totally satisfied that there was a differential, but we were very happy to report that the bar passage rate was 78%. So the differential exists. Some, like me, think of it as good news. Some believe it to be bad news. And Professor Sanders' thesis explores that differential and basically concludes it's exacerbated by affirmative action, by this mismatch. So here's my criticisms. And they're only, I think, three or four. And as I said, they don't relate to the methodology. The first is, I think he ignores the fact that there's a correlation between LSAT, the LSAT score you attain, and bar passage. Indeed, some have argued you can take the LSAT score and predict whether somebody will pass the bar, and that the what happens in the middle, law school, is of course important and correlated, but that the LSAT score itself will basically tell you who will pass the bar. And when you get to the bar passage study, you see one thing that's quite telling. The bar passage rates of African Americans who achieve above the mean LSAT score, above 153, is almost identical to that of whites. It's 98% versus 96%. Okay. And now remember, Professor Sanders' criticism, although not stated directly, seems to be on elite schools. So you have to ask yourself, who's getting into elite schools? Is it those individuals getting below the mean score, or those benefited by affirmative action who are getting above the mean score? And clearly, with respect to the elite schools and more selective schools, where we can take the top 50 law schools if you like, even with the use of affirmative action, those schools are not matriculating individuals with scores below the mean. So, you know, my first criticism is that there is some correlation between the LSAT score and bar passage, and to say that affirmative action affects all who are benefits of affirmative action exacerbates and actually misstates really what's happening with respect to the data. My guess, my surmise, and you can't tell based on the data, and indeed if you've read Professor Sanders' article, he says that it was unfortunate that the Law School Admissions Council chose to eliminate the identifiers and the bar passage data. We didn't choose to, we were contractually obligated to, because the only way we could get people to participate in the study was to say we're going to scrub your identity when the bar passage results were published, and we did. And so you can't go back and say these are the students who flunked the bar. So we're making guesses. And my guess is the students who are flunking the bar are not the students who got into the more selective schools as a result of affirmative action. It is those students who are getting into the less selective schools, those students on the bottom who are getting into the less selective law schools with lower LSATs that are flunking the bar. And if that's the case, you have to ask yourself another question, which is affirmative action worth having those students go to law school and then have them disproportionately flunk the bar? If the goal is to produce more lawyers, I think the answer has to be yes, because not all of those students are flunking the bar. Indeed, as I mentioned, 78% are eventually passing the bar. So if you look at affirmative action and if you think about the cascade effect with respect to admission into law school and where students are going as a result of their LSAT, my guess is that the elite schools are not having, well, they're not showing any loss as a result of the use of affirmative action with respect to blacks passing the bar. And you can actually tease out a little bit of this by looking at the passage rates for various schools in the years in question. If you went to the Stanford website and looked at the rates of graduation for 1994, you would see that Stanford had, I think, maybe misremembering, they had about 20 black students, and their bar passage rate was 98%, something like that. And so, you know, of those 20 students, one did not pass the bar. Maybe one did not pass the bar if that person was the one or two who did not. So, and if you go to Harvard and look at Boston, the results in Massachusetts with respect to the bar, you'll see the same thing. The other thing is, when you look at his thesis, some have commented about this. Part of what he seems to be saying is that if you go to a less selective law school, then you'll do better because you'll learn more law, which I mentioned earlier. And if that actually was true, then what you would see is Tennessee having a higher bar passage rate than, say, Vanderbilt, and I'll just stick with these examples. Boston having a higher passage rate, and you don't see that. You don't see that differential with respect to those passage rates. So my point is that there may be other reasons for the differential performance of African Americans that have nothing to do with grades and nothing to do with affirmative action. The other thing that he never addresses, because you can't really tease it out of the data set, is where blacks are flunking the bar. And what's interesting is that if you look at a different data set, what you'll find is that blacks take the bar predominantly in 10 states and some of the harder states to pass. And indeed, the study that I'm referring to, which is a second cut of the bar passage data, basically says that blacks, in effect, misapply when you look at bar passage, that they take the bar in states with a higher cut score, and given the scores that they attained, they could have passed had they chosen to take the bar in another state. And so to some extent, when you look at the differential that I talked about, what you'll see is that it doesn't reflect the fact that most blacks take the bar in California, New York, Maryland, Texas, and Georgia. I think those are the top five. And indeed, in 14 jurisdictions, 95% of African Americans take the bar. And so you have to look at that factor and the skew it provides with respect to the differential pass rate, and that may explain some of the differential rate as opposed to grades. My third and final, well, I won't even say it's third because I just thought of another one. I mentioned it earlier, but I just want to emphasize it because I saw it in my note. If you look at the differential pass rate and ask yourself what's going on, you have to also go back to what I mentioned earlier, which is there is this gap on what are called power tests that occurs with respect to every standardized test. And a power test is a test upon which something important turns, like an entitlement, like admission to law school, like admission to the bar. And what you see with every standardized test starting, and some people say it's the second grade, some people say it's the fourth, I'm willing to say, okay, whatever, junior high. Junior high after, you see this gap in the performance of black applicants versus white applicants. And it is there, it is in every test, and therefore, you know, there's no reason to believe it wouldn't be present in the bar exam, because that is indeed the ultimate power test. It is also a standardized test. So what you're seeing in that differential is not, quote, grades, and the fact that you're getting lower grades in law school as a result of affirmative action. You're seeing the same sort of gap that you see with all standardized tests. Does that mean it's good? No. Does it mean it's solvable? Well, no one's been able to solve it yet. Is there a reason for it? if you know a reason for it, you probably can win the Nobel Prize. I don't have an answer for it, but it's there. And so when I look at that differential outcome, I point to that gap, which exists in every standardized test as opposed to grades. Third point, if the goal is, that's not my fourth point, if the goal is to produce more lawyers, which seems to be the object of his thesis, Professor Sander assumes that without affirmative action or preferences in admission, African Americans, blacks, now properly admitted to law schools, which he calls selective law schools, will continue to go to law school, okay, when they get into less selective law schools. And I think that's fallacious. And in other words, he basically, and he addresses this towards the end of his article, he says at the end of the article, African Americans will apply and continue to go to law school even though their choice is not now Harvard, it's BU, or it's not Vanderbilt, it's Tennessee. And the reason why they will continue to go to law school at the same rate is because they now know they will pass a bar. Okay? And that will give them some comfort. And here's the problem. If a student has a 165 LSAT and is getting into Harvard or Vanderbilt, I guarantee you that African-American student is facing, as many of you obviously did, a choice. Do I want to go to law school? Do I want to go to grad school? Do I want to go to business school? Do I want to go to med school? Do I want to take a job? You know, tons of choices. You cannot tell me or convince me that choosing between Harvard and Boston University will not have some impact on that choice, that the ability to go to Harvard will not convince some students, yeah, I'll go to law school. Whereas if those students only got in or got into their best school as Boston, they would say, nope, I choose not to go to law school. I choose to go to wherever, or choose to do whatever. So I think there will be some leakage if indeed there is no use of affirmative action. And I think that Professor Sander's conclusion that they will continue to go to law school at the same rate is erroneous because, first, no one internalizes that they're going to fail the bar anyway. Right? I mean, you don't go to law school and say, well, you know, there's a strong probability I'm going to fail the bar. But I'm going to go anyway. But now that you told me I probably will pass the bar, I'm really going to go. I mean, no one does that. I've talked to students at a school which will remain nameless at a bar passage rate of 25% when I was on the ABA site team. And I said to the students, why would you go to this law school? The bar passage rate is 25%. You have to ask that question. And they said, not me. I'm not going to be the one. And indeed, those who even sort of realistic said, look, I just want a chance to take the bar exam. But so I don't think students are going to continue to go to law school simply because they believe they have a better chance of passing the bar. And indeed, when you look at the data, what we're talking about is, as I said, at the worst case scenario, which people believe to be the worst case scenario, 78% eventually passing the bar. And so I don't think his assertion that, yeah, this won't have any effect because they will continue to go to law school at the same rate. I think that if affirmative action is eliminated and if the mismatch is eliminated, which I agree exists, you will see less African Americans going to law school. So, I see my time is running out. So here's the deal. I don't think he can prove that more individuals would pass the bar if affirmative action is eliminated, because we're talking about some data sets that are actually probably not perfect for what he wants to claim, and he will never have the perfect data set to really demonstrate his thesis. I don't think I can prove that conclusively that he's wrong, because one of the data set, and we can't go back and say to these people in 1991, would you have gone to law school had you known 78% chance, you're getting A's at Vanderbilt versus B's at Virginia or whatever. I don't think we can do that. And so basically, at the end of the day, we're both making suppositions. So to me, the real issue is whether the absence of students of color in our most selective and prestigious law schools is an acceptable cost to incur in order to prove what may be a flawed hypothesis, this mismatch theory. And I think that alteration in current educational policy might well undo several decades of progress in the diversification of law schools and subsequently the bar. So for me, at the end of the day, the status quo is quite acceptable, eminently acceptable, and that's where I come out in this whole debate.